your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Afghan female school graduates are shedding tears of dismay after their exclusion by the Taliban rulers from the university entrance exam, also known as CONCOR. They have been studying hard for the national test in order to pursue higher education. But all that has been in vain, as the Taliban have announced that only male students can sit for the exam this year.
I wanted to pursue my higher education and become a leader and serve my people. But now they say that girls cannot take the university entrance exam. This is unfair and unjust. I am so sad and feel like my life is over.
I wanted to enroll in medical university and become a professional doctor and help my country prosper. But unfortunately, the Taliban shut the doors on our dreams and future and denied us our rights.
In a new report, UN human rights experts say the Taliban authorities have increased restrictions on women and girls in Afghanistan in recent months. The UN has urged the Taliban to respect and protect the rights of all Afghans, especially women and girls, and to ensure their access to education, healthcare, and other essential services.
With all these restrictions on women in place, Afghanistan's future is looking increasingly bleak. Girls and women are losing hope as they are being excluded from all political, social, and educational spheres.
The Taliban have not given any clear indication of when or if girls will be able to resume their studies at high schools or universities. They say they are upholding women's rights in accordance with their interpretation of Sharia law and Afghan culture. No other Muslim country in the world imposes such restrictions on women's education. The fate of Afghan girls remains uncertain as they are being barred from most educational settings. For many of them, education not only is a source of knowledge, but also a source of hope and empowerment. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iranians from all walks of life once again out on the streets, chanting slogans and using the strongest terms to express their anger.
Protesters rallied in the Iranian capital, Tehran, after the Friday prayers, along with a number of other major cities across the country, to condemn the desecration of the Holy Quran.
The protesters also called on the foreign ministry to cut ties with Sweden. This is the second time in less than a month that an Iraqi refugee in Stockholm has committed the sacrilegious act with protection from Swedish police.
No one should allow themselves to insult our religious beliefs. This is absolutely unacceptable.
We just had to take part in this rally to get our voices heard.
The Swedish government has allowed this to happen, and we are here to express our anger.
We are here for our holy book, for our religion.
Later in the day, protesters once again gathered outside the Swedish embassy in Tehran, demanding the ambassador to leave the country.
It's the second time this is happening, so we should definitely show a stronger reaction.
Iranians are very well aware of the consequences of such blasphemous acts. That is why you see so many of us here.
We will not stop until the Swedish ambassador leaves our country.
This is exactly what we want our officials to do. The foreign ministry has to expel the ambassador, and we will continue these rallies until he leaves.
The Iranian foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to Tehran on Thursday, but the protesters are now calling for the expulsion of the ambassador. They are planning another rally in front of the foreign ministry in the coming days, demanding Iran to cut ties with Sweden. Gizem Shahmadi, Tehran.
Iranian Minister of Justice Amin Hossein Rahimi arrived in Damascus and met with his Syrian counterpart, Ahmad al-Sayed. The two officials underlined the importance of uniting efforts legally and judicially to face unjust lawsuits filed in international entities by the United States and its Western allies against member countries of the Resistance Alliance, as well as working together to lift unjust sanctions on both countries. An initial agreement has been reached to form a joint legal committee for this purpose.
We will be signing a memorandum of understanding on exchanging expertise and organizing workshops. Western countries claim they respect international law while they are the ones who violated the most. This is also the situation in northeast Syria. They loot Syria's oil, wheat, and cotton. Those are crimes committed against international law and UN Charter. There should be a legal deterrent. International law should be implemented.
The Iranian official also met with Syria's foreign minister Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed ways to improve the historic relations between the two countries in service of both peoples. Rahimi said political and military relations between the two countries reached their highest levels during the war on Syria, reiterating the need to bolster economic and judicial partnerships.
The main focus of my visit is proposing to form a joint legal committee between Syria and Iran and other member countries of the Resistance Alliance to create a defense line against lawsuits filed against us by the enemies, and also to legally work to force the hegemonic regimes to compensate for the losses they inflicted on Syria, especially on its infrastructure. We should demand that in international entities.
Rahimi also visited Syria's People's Assembly, where he met with its speaker, Hamoud Sabbagh. The top Iranian official said his country will continue assisting the Syrian people, mainly in reconstructing what war had destroyed. Syrian and Iranian officials are keen on continuously exchanging visits in a show of serious willingness to further boost bilateral cooperation in all fields. This visit aims to develop judicial collaboration to match the political strategic ties between the two states. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Rush hour, Washington, D.C. Protesters assemble for demonstrations at a busy intersection.
We want 48!
A second day of demonstrations, timed to coincide with the second day of Israeli President Isaac Herzog's U.S. visit, concluded a joint address to Congress. His reaffirmation of a binding relationship between the U.S. and Israel was not kindly received by everyone.
It's a moral imperative as an American citizen where $3.8 billion of our tax money is going to fund apartheid and racism, death and imprisonment for people is something I, as an American citizen, need to speak out against.
Herzog characterized a true friendship between the allies, his relationship with the U.S. troubling to those embarked upon continued human rights abuses of Palestinians.
Our people in the homeland and outside the homeland continue to suffer from being bombed, whether it's in the Gaza Strip, or raids in the West Bank, for example, like with what's happened in Jenin, or even in 48 Palestine, with what's happening, for example, in certain poor Palestinian cities.
Protesters have been standing out here for hours, temporarily shutting down this busy D.C. intersection. Passersby occasionally honk their horns to show support for the demonstrators. These protesters are worried about several issues, including more Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, and a potential judicial overhaul headed by Benjamin Netanyahu's regime that could give political allies control over the appointment of judges.
Judaism is a religion of 3,000 years to be subservient to God, and Zionism is a takeover. It's a transformation to nationalism. A base political, selfish, flawed nationalist movement.
What do we want?
Justice!
What do we want it?
Now!
If we don't get it,
shut it down!
Observers have long accused Israel of being human rights in the occupied West Bank. A 2021 report by Human Rights Watch said Israel's policies amount to apartheid and persecution. Colin Campbell, Washington.
FIFTY leaders from the EU and CELAC countries gathered in Brussels on Monday and Tuesday in what was the first summit of its kind for 8 years. CELAC consists of 33 nations in Latin America and the Caribbean. Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Ralph Gonsalves, is currently CELAC president. He says the war in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia have brought misery to millions of citizens.
Rising prices, shortages of goods, and it's not just the war. It's the sanctions upon the war, price of fuel, of food, borrowing of monies and so on.
Gonsalves certainly wasn't the only leader to tell EU decision makers that peace negotiations are needed to end the war in Ukraine.
La guerra de Ucrania.
The war in Ukraine must come to an end. The European Union and CELAC must, as an obligation, look for a way towards peace. We cannot live with this nightmare that any day now may see all hell break loose on all of us.
It was clearly an uncomfortable event for EU leaders as they wanted to focus on securing new energy supplies and critical raw materials in order to further isolate Russia and become less dependent on China. The visiting leaders refused to blindly follow the EU's anti-Russia rhetoric, analysts point out.
They're much more willing to call out what they see as the hypocrisy of great powers, you know, talking about other great powers and how they bully small states, given the histories of colonialism and American imperialism within Latin America.
The EU did manage to sign trade deals with Chile, Argentina and Uruguay on the sidelines of the summit. However, the relentless criticism of the 27-nation bloc support for the war continued.
O mundo gastou.
The world has spent $2.24 trillion to fuel the war machine that only causes death, destruction and even more hunger. This summit is a way for us to say enough with that. Another world is possible.
Not only have calls here on EU leaders to facilitate peace negotiations fallen on deaf ears, but later this week EU foreign ministers will meet to agree on ways to apply more pressure on Russia while providing additional support to Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Money in exchange for stopping Tunisians from leaving the country. That's the core of the Memorandum of Understanding sealed in Tunis on Sunday by the outgoing Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte and the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, under the supervision of the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Actually, the memorandum is rather vague on financial figures. Some media have reported that the deal is worth 1 billion euros. Others say that the figures stipulated could change according to developments on the ground. What has emerged so far is that the EU intends to provide 105 million euros to Tunis to curb irregular migration. According to the European Coast Guard agency Frontex, there were more than 100,000 illegal border crossings through the central Mediterranean last year, a 50% rise compared to 2021, with Italy struggling to cope with this surge in arrivals.
We want real equality and do not want sympathy without respect. Today we need a collective agreement on inhuman migration and on the displacement processes behind which criminal networks hide. The world has been divided in two, half for the rich and half for the poor. It is no longer possible for this monetary system to continue in the same form and content. This global monetary system creates darkness wherever it wants.
Tunisia, together with Libya, is considered one of the main gateways for asylum seekers who wish to reach European shores. The country has often been described by Western media as being in a state of financial malaise following the COVID-19 pandemic, rising inflation, high unemployment, and a worldwide swell in commodity prices. According to some EU leaders, Brussels should make the Cash for Migrant Control Accord with Tunisia a model for similar deals with other countries. The EU has reportedly been in talks with Egypt on a similar agreement.
The partnership with Tunisia has to be considered as a model for building new relations with North African neighbors. All these, a few months ago, would have been unthinkable.
The EU is also willing to put on the table a substantial package of macro-financial assistance to, quote, support Tunisia's fragile economy and prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Tunisian President Saied has repeatedly rejected what he calls diktats of the international financial institutions, which have tried to persuade Tunisia to remove state subsidies on basic goods, such as fuel and bread. Saied has said these measures will only lead to more poverty and are unacceptable. Max Civili, Rome.
More than 500 Iranian enterprises and companies gathered to take part in an award ceremony that is expected to up their games and also allow them to gain a foothold in the OIC economy. Nearly 150 of them passed the quality control test to acquire four-star status, the highest defined by the Standard and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries, also referred to as SMIC.
This award, or better said, the four-star certificate, represents the highest standard of Iranian products, according to OIC member states. It will allow our companies to export their goods and services to OIC member states and also improve market conditions and competitiveness.
The standard, bring the specification of the products. If you know what is the products, what ingredients, what the specification of the products, you can easily trade. And this brings also international recognition of the products, and free trade will bring the remove the barriers.
The companies that were awarded the certificate and acquired the four-star status couldn't agree more.
I believe that the true award is the trust that our customers have in our products. The fact that they believe our name stands for high-quality products, for me, is more valuable than any award or certificate.
The companies that are active in food industries definitely require international standards, and for OIC member states, the halal standard is of great importance. We tried very hard to reach this level and gain the four stars and the halal certificate.
The Standards and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries is the most important organization in compiling standards in the fields of food, health, and tourism management systems accepted by 57 member states of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. The Islamic Republic of Iran is one of the most active members of the Technical Committee of SMIC. As an institute developing the necessary mechanisms in the OIC, the Standards and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries is paving the way for member states to recognize each other's standard certificates. This will in turn help to boost trade. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
As the U.S. is sending cluster bombs to Ukraine, the deadly legacy of these destructive U.S. weapons continues to take its toll on civilians in other countries, including Afghanistan. According to Human Rights Watch, the U.S. dropped more than 1,200 cluster bombs containing tens of thousands of bombless in Afghanistan in the first 3 years of its invasion of the country. As a result, hundreds of Afghan people were killed, wounded, or maimed forever.
It was 10 p.m. when bombardment started on our house. I was targeted with an American bomb while fleeing the bombardment. I lost my feet and my hand was injured. Since then, I have been living a terrible life.
The Taliban's official for martyrs and disabled affairs also says the U.S. war on Afghanistan has created many victims, especially from cluster bombs.
Most martyrs, disabled and maimed people registered by our administration or harmed by the U.S. indiscriminate rocket strikes and cluster bombs. The U.S. used to claim they were targeting Taliban fighters, but their destructive war machines destroyed an entire village and left no civilian unharmed.
Military experts have warned that unexploded cluster bombs across Afghanistan are still posing a serious threat to the lives of innocent people, including school children, shepherds, and farmers.
War was ongoing in all 34 provinces of Afghanistan. Cluster bombs were dropped by NATO and American forces in most places. I'm sure that they're not cleared yet, especially in the outskirts of the cities, mountainous in conflict areas. They pose a serious threat to civilians there. International bodies and NGOs as well as the Taliban should solve the problem as soon as possible.
Afghan people urge the international community to prevent the use of cluster bombs globally and hold the U.S. accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan. The U.S. left Afghanistan 2 years ago, but its unexploded bombs are still here, posing threat to the lives of innocent people. Afghans are calling for justice and support from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In the limelight.
UK inflation is stuck at 8.7%, higher than forecast. Stubbornly high prices across a broad range of goods and services pile pressure on Bank of England to raise interest rates. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Financial Times reported UK inflation remained stuck at 8.7% in May, higher than expectations of a drop to 8.4%, marking the fourth month in a row that price rises have exceeded forecasts. With the cost of a broad range of goods and services rising sharply, the figures will reinforce expectations of multiple interest rate increases to come from the Bank of England, intensifying the mortgage time bomb facing many households across the UK. Two-year gilt yields climbed 156 tenth percentage points after the data added to pressure on the Bank of England to do more to cool rising prices. The two-year gilt yielded hit 5.1% in early trade, the highest level since 2008. The Bank of England is expected to raise rates again with an increase of at least 25 tenth percentage points from 4.5% to 4.75%. Following these figures, the odds indicated by swaps markets of a larger 5 tenth percentage point rise climbed to around 40%. Traders are now betting that UK interest rates will peak at 6% by early next year. Analysts said there was next to no good news in the inflation data for the UK. Core inflation, which excludes volatile food and energy prices, rose again in May to 7.1% from 6.8% the previous month, the highest rate since March 1992. Services prices were also up 7.4%, also the highest rate in more than 30 years. The monthly increase in overall prices of 0.7% in May alone suggests that the current rate of price increases is not slowing down. Paul Dales, chief UK economist at Capital Economics, said the Bank of England would have to fight tougher to bring down inflation because the acceleration in core inflation leaves the UK looking increasingly like the global outlier and the stagflation nation. Kitty Usher, chief economist at the Institute of Directors, said the only question for the Bank of England now was how much to increase the cost of borrowing. She said the failure of inflation to come down was probably caused by the continuing impact of high energy costs and a strong wage pressure being passed through to prices, all overlaid with high demand for leisure activities among households with disposable incomes. Financial Times added, in the details of the figures, price rises again easily offset price cuts, with significant rises in the cost of airfares, package holidays, music events, games and toys. These were partially offset by falling prices for petrol and diesel. Food price inflation dipped from 19% in April to 18.3% in May, but the cost of food itself in supermarkets still rose 0.9% in the month of May alone. The UK's inflation rate of 8.7% in May compared poorly with those in other countries. The equivalent figures are 6% in France, 6.3% in Germany, 7.1% across the whole of the EU, and 2.7% in the US, using the most comparable measures. Meanwhile, Bloomberg noted UK food costs remain stubbornly high. According to Bloomberg, grocery inflation in the UK has started to ease as two separate surveys suggest that food price growth may have passed its peak. Food inflation in the country fell for the third consecutive month in June, but it still remains at 16.5%, down from 17.2% the previous month, according to the data from market research company Kantar. Inflation stands at its sixth highest level since the financial crisis in 2008, according to Kantar. Eggs, cooking sauces and frozen potato products saw the biggest price rises. Another study conducted by Lloyds Bank said food production costs in the UK declined for the first time in May since 2016. Grocery price growth reached 19.1% in April, which was the highest rate in more than 45 years, according to the Office for National Statistics, ONS. Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey earlier warned that the easing of inflation could take longer than expected. Head of Retail and Consumer Insight at Kantar, Fraser McKevitt, said the ongoing squeeze is clearly weighing on the nation's mind. Of the top five financial worries that consumers have, rising grocery prices is the only one that are more concerned about now than the start of this year. An index tracking costs for food producers fell for the first time in more than 7 years, a Lloyds survey showed. However, it will still take some time before we see the benefit in terms of shelf prices, according to Inabel Finally, Managing Director of Food, Drink and Leisure at Lloyds Bank Commercial Banking. She added, This is in part due to the long-term nature of contracts between the manufacturers and retailers, as well as the broader segments of the production chain. Earlier, UK officials reportedly met with supermarket bosses to negotiate price cuts, reassuring them that any scheme to help bring down food prices for consumers would be voluntary. Last week, Ken Morphy, CEO of Britain's biggest supermarket chain, Tesco, pointed to some signs of cooling grocery inflation after the company cut prices on bread, pasta, and broccoli, but admitted that it's unlikely that prices will return to where they were.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. For the second time in a month, the Swedish police has granted permission for the desecration of the Holy Quran in Stockholm. As a result, anger is now boiling over in the Muslim world with calls for expulsion of Swedish envoys from Islamic countries and the boycotting of Swedish products by Muslims. Sweden says it opposes a sacrilegious act but has given the green light for it in the name of freedom of speech. But are the Western countries really committed to providing all peoples with a right to freely express their beliefs, or is it just another political tool for advancing their policies? Let's discuss that in tonight's Spotlight with our guests. Matthew Tarr, founder of Al-Qaim Seminary, joining us from Rome. And historian and journalist Brecht Jonkers joining us from Hasselt, Belgium. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Taib in Rome. Share with us your perspective on what has happened in Sweden over the past month. Iran's foreign minister just recently has warned that the desecration of the Holy Quran will have dire consequences and called on Sweden to stop promoting violence and sowing discord. Why would Swedish officials allow such an act to happen again?
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Thank you for having me. I think it's not the first time that we see this type of actions for burning Quran or other holy books in different parts of the world by the extremists. I think we need to realize the reality of what's going on. On one side, we have a book that we know as the holy book, the book of God. On the other side, we have certain individuals who are burning these books, and also certain governments, certain regimes that are protecting them and giving them full support. Okay, we might not be able to know who those people are who are burning the book, but we know what these books are. We've been reading these books for thousands of years. We have the Holy Quran between us for 1,400 years now. So let's see how Quran introduces itself to people. Let's see what the teachings of the Quran is, so that by knowing what the Quran is, we get to know who those people who are burning the Holy Quran are, and those governments, those politicians who are giving them green lights to do this, to do such actions. So if we refer to the Holy Book, if we refer to the Holy Quran, I think we get to understand what this book really is. Quran, in the first pages of it, introduces itself as the book of guidance. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alif lam mim, dhalika al-kitab, la rayba fi, hudan lil-muttaqin. This is a book, there's now no doubt in it. If you read it, you can argue even one single point of it. There's always answers for every single point in it. And it's a guidance. It's a book of guidance for the God-weary, for those pious people. The second thing, let's take a look at the teachings of the Holy Quran. Quran, number one, teaches justice to people. Quran is a book of justice in more than 22 ayahs, in more than 22 verses. Quran is talking about the philosophy of justice. Quran is talking about the reason why prophets were sent down to us, and it was there to uphold justice. Quran is telling us that if we want to judge between people, we have to be just. Quran is telling us that we have to fight for a government that can bring justice for people, and we need to establish a government, the final and universal government of the Savior that will bring justice to people. So Quran is a book of justice. All over this book, when you read this book, you see it's talking about justice. Second, Quran is a book of freedom. Quran is telling us, is telling those who read this book, not to accept the authority and the power of anyone but God. Quran says you are free. You were born free. You were created free. And you have your freedom. Even this book as a book of guidance, even this book as a book of God, Quran says, I am telling you what the right path is. If you want, you can choose it. If you don't want it, choose other ways. إِنَّا هَدَيْنَاكُمُ السَّبِيلِ أَمَّا شَاكَرًا وَأَمَّا كَفُورًا. We just show you the right way. We just show you what the destination and what the way, what the path towards the destination is. We won't force you. So this is another point. Quran is a book of freedom. Quran highly values the freedom of people. The second thing, if you want to go over the teachings of this book so that we know, we may be able to know who the enemies of this book are. Quran is a book of virtue. Quran is a book of morality. In many of its verses, Quran is inviting people to worship only one God. And the second thing that Quran says after worshiping only one God, which is God the Almighty, he says, وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا. You have to be kind to your parents.
All right, let's bring in Mr. Jonkers in on the discussion. Brecht, the Sacrilegious Act in Sweden, as we know, has drawn condemnation from across the Muslim world. Iranians, earlier, we saw them stage a sit-in outside the Swedish embassy demanding the expulsion of the Swedish ambassador. Similar rallies were held in capital cities of Iraq, Pakistan, and Lebanon as well. The renowned Egyptian university has chimed in, saying Al-Azhar University has called for boycotting Swedish products. Several Muslim states have summoned the Swedish envoys. Was the international backlash from the previous incident not a big enough sign for Sweden, or was it just ignored on purpose?
Well, I think they definitely chose to ignore it. They could have done the reasonable thing, and that is pulling their hands off of the situation. The Swedish government could have said, yeah, okay, we made a mistake. There was definitely a problem made here with this one rabidly Islamophobic person who burned the Quran. Of course, the problem is that even the first instance of Quran desecration that happened in Sweden this month happened with explicit permission from the Swedish government. Indeed, the Stockholm said in advance that this completely pre-planned and known priorly organized event of Quran desecration would be allowed to pass without anyone stopping him, because of the fact, quote unquote, because of the freedom of speech policies that Sweden claims to have. And now they have done it again, despite the fact that the desecration has drawn the ire of so many Muslims, of millions of Muslims, about, I think, almost every single Muslim of the over 1.5 billion Muslims that there are is angry about this. But the problem is that the Swedish government, I believe, just doesn't care. And in fact, it's not just that they don't care. It is actually part, I believe, of a far larger and a far more, I would call it sinister, plan. And that is, they use the ire of Muslims, the anger of Muslims, in a way to portray us as Muslims as being somewhat barbaric, as being too touchy, as being too easily angered, because the Swedish government can always say, well, we didn't, you know, hurt anyone. We didn't physically attack anyone. We didn't bomb anyone. But what they don't realize, or what they don't want to realize, is the fact that this, of course, hurts the very soul of the Islamic people, the very in the very psyche, the very heart of all Muslims everywhere in the world. And the problem in Europe, and especially in countries that are majority atheists, such as Sweden nowadays, is that it is very difficult for the ordinary European person to really grasp how insulting this is. Because now for over a century already, Europe, especially Northern Europe, has been for a major part secular or even atheistic, and especially, that's especially the case in Scandinavia. So even if someone were to, let's say, burn the Bible in response, this would not really convey any proper message to the Swedish, even though Sweden is theoretically a Protestant Christian country, because the reach that Christianity has been reduced so massively over the past decades that there is very, very little connection anymore between the Christian faith, or any faith really, and the national psyche of people, a lot of people, especially in countries like Sweden. So the Swedish government and the Islamophobes in general in Europe can now say that this is an exaggeration on behalf of the Muslims. They can say that the Muslims are exaggerating. They are now stating that Iran is exaggerating, that Al-Azhar University is exaggerating, that Iraq has been exaggerating by demanding the extradition of this person who has burned the Quran, who is originally an Iraqi citizen. And this can all be used to further the Islamophobic agenda and further fan the flames of Islamophobia, which, of course, does not mean that I believe the anger is unjustified. I think we absolutely have a duty, a religious duty as Muslims, to oppose any form of desecration of our religious texts and the Holy Book of God.
Mr. Jonkers, the Swedish foreign minister said that Stockholm condemns the sacrilege and the desecration does not reflect the position of the Swedish government. The foreign minister also said, this was in a phone conversation with Iranian foreign minister, he said that Swedish police did not grant any permission for insulting the Holy Book of Muslims, adding that the permit for an assembly was abused. Now that's a conflicting stance from what Sweden expressed just weeks ago, where they claimed they were allowing freedom of speech to prevail. How do you read into these recent comments?
Well, simply put, the second statement is a lie. I think the Swedish government and the Swedish ministers have been absolutely lying now that they say that the desecration and the burning of the Quran was not the plan, now that they say that they had no idea that that is what these people were going to be doing. Because even if that were true, then at least the police would have intervened at the moment when they were starting to hold up the Quran, tear it apart, and, you know, try to burn it in flames. If this was not allowed, if this was not pre-planned, if this was not known by law enforcement, then obviously the police would have intervened at that point and said, you are going too far, this goes beyond, you know, the freedom of speech as we understand it. Of course, in reality, the Swedish government knew what was going to happen, and in fact, long before the burning took place, weeks before already, it was known across the world that this was going to happen, and the Swedish government, as you said, indeed said that if this were to take place, this is all protected under the quote-unquote freedom of speech laws of Sweden. This is the reason why they backtrack a bit and now say, like, oh, you know, we as a government of Sweden have nothing really to do with this. This was an individual act. But, well, it was nothing criminal according to the law, so we can't really do anything. That is a very typical action taken by the, so to say, the liberal governments and the social democratic governments and the centrist, quote-unquote centrist, political parties across Europe, and that the strategy here is by slowly fomenting and increasing Islamophobia without sounding overtly Islamophobic or overtly racist. There are actually very few governments in Europe that are led by overt Islamophobes or overt racists. This is all done and despite the fact that they are not overtly racist and not overtly Islamophobic, you see in reality that Islamophobia is constantly increasing. You know, Muslims are not allowed in many countries to have their own religious education. Muslims are not allowed to appoint their own imams anymore. In many places, the Muslim councils are being severely restricted across the board in all of Europe nowadays. And then things like this happen. And the reason why they do that is to have plausible deniability. The government in Stockholm has now further increased Islamophobia just one step further or a few steps further, further increasing the message that they send to the significant Muslim minority in Sweden, saying that, you know, this is what we think of you, and you are allowed to live here, but you basically are not allowed to really fully commit to your religion. You have to be
indeed
first and foremost. And at the same time, they have that plausible deniability because the Swedish government can now say, we have never said anything Islamophobic ourselves. We haven't really done anything directly personally, so please don't blame us. That is that strategy that not just the Swedish, but also, you know, the French, the British, the Belgian governments have been doing this for decades now.
Matti Taibbi, let's readdress the question to you. On Thursday, Iraq expelled the Swedish ambassador and recalled its envoy from Stockholm. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has urged all Muslim nations to follow suit. In your opinion, what can the collective Muslim population do to prevent such acts from happening again?
If you give me a few moments, I would like to explain more what happened so that our readers understand the depth of this issue, because it may not all be Muslims or people who know Islam. So let's explain to them what happened really so that we have a lot of people on board of what's happening right now. As I was saying, we have on one hand, we have some people who burned the Holy Quran, and the government has protected those people who did those actions. And on the other side, we have the Holy Book. We said we have to know what this book is. And if you refer to the Holy Quran itself, it introduces itself as a book of guidance. And the teachings of the Quran, we have to know what the teachings of the Quran are that are bothering those people who are burning this Quran. There has to be something within this book that's bothering the government and those people who've done these actions. The teachings of the Quran, one is teaching people the oneness of God and inviting people to believe in the oneness of God. Second is justice. In numerous verses, Quran is talking about upholding justice in the world. And in the third teaching, Quran is teaching us that we have freedom, we were born free, and we have to gain freedom through establishing a just government. The fourth teaching that we see in the Quran is the teachings of akhlaq and value and morality. As I was saying, Quran next to saying, don't worship anyone except the Almighty God, it says, respect your parents. It says, go and take care of the orphans. Next to the orders that Quran says, next to the commandments that says, don't lie, don't cheat, don't backbite. Next to all of these things, it says, take care of orphans and be just and have freedom and fight for your freedom. This is the book that we're talking about. You may say this is not a book of God. In this book, God says himself that, okay, if you say this is not a book of God, bring 10 verses like this. Go and gather all the scientists, everyone that you know who's capable of writing good. Bring them all the learned and knowledgeable people, and bring me 10 verses like this book. And you can't. God says you can't. And over the 1400 years after the Quran was revealed to us, no one, absolutely no one, was able to bring even one verse like this book. Let's put this aside. Now, what is the purpose? Now that we know what this Quran is, now that we know this book is the book of justice, freedom, morality.
I'm sorry, Mr. Todd, I'm going to have to jump in there. We're going to have to keep this discussion going. Back to our guest in Hasselt, Belgium. Brett Jonkers, the main question, I think the core question here would be, who benefits from such senseless and hateful actions? I'm going to take you back to a statement that came from Yemen. The government there, when the first sacrilege took place, said, targeting Islamic sanctities is an act encouraged by the Israeli lobby that dominates Europe. Do you see it in that light as well?
I think it is. It's a very apt statement. And across the world, there are only a few governments, I think, who would dare to say things in such a clear and apt way. And Yemen is definitely one of them. The Zionist lobby, and these are lobbies, actually, that are not exclusively, you know, Jewish in any way. They're not synonymous with the Jewish community. That's always something that I want to clarify, especially for the viewers in Western countries, Zionist lobbies, which for a big part are located in countries like the United States and the United Kingdom, and of course within the Zionist entity itself, have an extensive influence on the political elites in Europe and in the United States itself. We've seen that recently when the Prime Minister of the Zionist entity visited the United States. He had an absolute standing ovation in the House of Representatives by every single member, both Democrats and Republicans, who are present there, even though he has never done anything for the United States openly. So it was a little bit of a strange welcome for a foreign leader. But not just in the U.S., it is the same thing in most Western countries, and especially in West European countries, that these lobby groups have a significant influence. These lobby groups are invested within the liberal circles, within the neoconservative circles of politics. They dominate a big part of both the left and the right wing. And what they are trying to do is basically create this sort of unipolar, single-minded, unified, liberal, capitalist ideology in which there is no place for anything transcendental. There is no place for anything religious. There is no place for anything spiritual, really, except for maybe things like, you know, reading the palm of your hand and putting tarot cards and reading the stars and stuff like that, if that makes you feel better. But there is no real deeper spiritual meaning allowed anymore to life for these in the viewpoint of these elites. And so what they've been trying to do, and unfortunately this has been very successful, is reduce any form spirituality and religion, especially Christianity, to a position of non-importance. And they have failed to do so for Islam. They have failed to influence even the Muslims who live in Europe to abandon religion. And therefore, the only other path that they know to be taking is outright and open Islamophobia.
Sure. Back to our guests in Rome. Mr. Taib, there's some heavy inconsistency when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech, specifically in European countries. We've seen comedians and artists' careers being obliterated if they criticize Israel or the occupation of Palestine. They're immediately being accused of being anti-Semitic. But all of a sudden, it's freedom of speech when it's burning of the Quran or publishing caricatures of holy and religious figures. Explain that hypocrisy and inconsistency for us, please.
All these concepts that you mentioned, like the freedom of speech, like the concept that we hear a lot about the human rights, these are all concepts that politicians and powers are using to maintain their power. So they use it the way they like. They use it the way it serves their purposes. And I think the media activists today, they all know that this is the reality. And the people of the world have started to realize and this is the reality, that when they say freedom of speech, we know that you are free to say whatever you want unless it's against their benefits. I mean, the politicians and the powers. If you do so, they will arrest you, they will take you down, they will torture you, they will kidnap you, you will disappear, no one knows where you are, and they do whatever they want. Or if, for example, you want to talk about what's happening in Palestine and the massacre and the injustice taking place in